October 29th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak or Tangerine SDR. It is 1 UTC. My name is Dave at KV0S, and this week I've been busy with work a little bit. Did some work on my shack. I also compiled LinHP SDR on the Odroid and seemed to be able to get it to work just fine, so, and even with a GPS running in the background, so no audio problems. I have tried to record something. I had a little trouble getting the recording to go out and back into Audacity. So otherwise, that was my small success this week. And so we'll go down the list. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Yes, I have even less success to report. Probably nothing I even want to talk about. Worked on CAD, code, the magnetometers generally, but not much satisfaction at this point anywhere.
Well, that's not fine business, but glad that you were here and willing to share what you've done. Next on the list, we have Mike AA8K, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. And then next on the list, we have Nathan into NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Thank you, Dave. Things are going fine here in Scranton. I spent a lot of time doing school stuff this week. I did get LinHP SDR running on Ubuntu, and we were able to use it with the Red Pitaya running HP SDR. But I think we're being overtaken by some local AM station, which we see. I see that harmonic looks like it's a harmonics all throughout the band. So you need to get some filtering on there. Aside from that, that's about it for this week. So I'll send it back to the group.
Fine business, Nathan. And next on the list, we have Rick, W2GPS, shown as Mike as away. And then we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everybody on the group. It's been a busy week working on schematic capture for the receiver unit, digging into lots of little quirks on the analog devices chip. I hope Scotty shows up. Maybe he can help answer a few questions that have arisen. Got most of the CAD models done for the parts and got a start on the schematic capture. And that's about it for the week.
Well, that sounds like good progress. So next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Hello, everyone. Well, I spent the weekend in Phoenix with Scotty.
User entered your channel.
There he is. Just arrived. So we were able to compile LinHP SDR on the CADAS Vim 3. We also got it working fairly well on the Odroid N2 board. It's not perfect. It still has some little bangs and clicks every once in a while. And we also have somewhat degraded performance when we turn up the frame rate on the Spectrum display. So anyway, we did make quite a bit of progress with that. And I think we both really like the Vim 3 board. It seemed to work really well. It's a little bit more expensive than the Odroid N2, but it did work very, very well. Anyway, I'm back in Raleigh now, and back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, and we miss Scotty, so let's go back and catch Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Sorry I'm late. Get stuck in traffic again here. Can't seem to get here quite on time. Maybe when we switch to the later time for us anyway. Same time for you guys, but later time for us. Next week? I think that's next week. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dave. But anyway, yeah, so Dan filled you in on the two boards we got working. And Dan, I got a little more information. When I turned what HTOP on to look at the CPU usage, when I increased the frame rate up past about the 5 or so, you start getting the clicks and pops. But when I raise it all the way up to 50 frames per second, it gets no worse, and it adds just as load on like the third core of the CPU. So it's almost like maybe it's not sharing as well as the other boards do. So, and I've been working on the specification for the protocol for the LCC, and that's hopefully I can get that done this week. But I'm going to have to take a break because I have to author an article for QEX. So that's due at the end of the week. So I have to work on that some. So that's going to be some more fun. So back over to you, Dave.
Fine business. And I think we've gone through everybody. So we're open for general discussion.
Hi, Scotty. This is Tom. I have a couple of questions if you've got the time.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, first question. The SPI interface on the analog devices part uses what's called a three-wire SPI mode instead of the normal four-wire. Have you heard of that before?
Yeah, I've heard of three-wire and four-wire. I thought the difference was that they eliminate the chip select and it was just always active. But you said it was a shared data line. Instead of MISO and MOSI, they have one bidirectional one?
Yes, that's correct. They have a slave sync, a clock, and a bidirectional data line.
Yeah, we can do that in the FPGA. That's no problem.
Okay, so what logic levels can the FPGA do all of that at 1.8 volt logic?
I believe we can. It doesn't have to be fast, right?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have to be fast. You know, it's like a megabit per second or something.
Yeah, we just have to make sure that the pins we use that we connect it to, I can set to 1.8. So I'm going to have to do some bank assignments there. And, you know, we may end up, if that's particular to that ADC, we may end up just moving the pins over to the second receive side, because I don't think we need both receive channels, right, since they're multiplexed?
In reading your instructions, I assigned half of the data pins on one receive side and half the data pins on the other.
Okay, I have to look at that. That's not what I suggested. Or we it's not. You didn't read what I wrote. So I don't think so. I'll let me go back and look at the schematic that you sent me.
Okay, I'd appreciate if you'd look at that. I sent you the schematic to see if I understood correctly your instructions. The reason I ask about the logic levels is for the three-wire SPI mode, I can't find a way to do voltage translation through a device that's capable of three-wire SPI compatibility.
Yeah, we shouldn't do that, because with that bidirectional pin, I don't see how you're going to do it, because you need to have some intelligence in when you switch the direction, right?
Yeah, the I2C translator has that intelligence built in. It looks at the clock, I2C clock line, and the I2C data line, and it starts firing one-shots to figure out what direction the translator should go. But I don't think that works on SPI.
Yeah, and I just assume not have translators if we can avoid it. And the FPGA will do 1.8 volts. It's just that we got to make sure that we can strap it there for 1.8. And then, you know, at some point, if we use a 3.3 volt part, we're going to have to be able to set it to there. So, and that'll be independent of the banks, of the data banks. So, because I'm thinking the 17-bit inputs to the DE, which would be outputs for you, ADC outputs, there's two 17-bit channels coming out of the RF module and one 14-bit channel going in, and each of those three channels should be strappable to a voltage, 1.8, 2.5, 3.3, individually, and actually the other three on the other module. So there's really going to be like six jumpers to set the voltages on those buses. And then we have to set the voltages on the I2C bus also. So it's going to be interesting to see how many, you know, I only have like, I think I have 12 banks.
User joined your channel.
Okay, I tentatively have a voltage translator on the I2C to go from 3.3 volts down to 1.8. But I'm sorry, up to 5 volts. I have to translate the 3.3 volt I squared C up to 5 volts because the I squared C latch I'm using is a relay driver and it's got clamp diodes in it. So I have to translate up on that one anyway. If we can avoid voltage translation on SPI, I think we can make this doable. Otherwise we have a real major problem.
Okay. Well, the ID one is going to be at 3.3 volts fixed, right?
Yeah. It's on its own separate pins. It's on a 3.3 volt supply and it doesn't get involved with anything else.
So then the attenuator bus is going to be 5 volts and the ADC bus is going to be 1.8?
No, the attenuator, there's a relay controller, and what I did is put a translator on it. So it's 3.3 volts I squared C on the connector interface to the module. And then the translator adapts that to whatever the module needs. So in my case, I adapt it to 5 volts, but all that's done on the receiver module and you never see it.
Okay, good, because I can't do 5 volts on the FPGA without translators.
Yeah, I took a note in the meeting minutes for last week. We agreed that I squared C should always be 3.3 volts no matter what.
Okay, and then the SPI we can argue over because I'm not averse to taking even the transmit bus outputs and repurposing a few of the pins because, I mean, really, when you plug this module in, you're not going to have any inputs for, you know, it's not a transmit module. So all those pins, if they're on 1.8 volts, can be made into SPI or data or anything you want.
Yeah, that we're going to have to do that because, you know, with SPI being 1.8 and I squared C being 3.3, we can no longer share the pins between the interfaces.
Yeah, it's too bad. We are. Yeah, there's not really any way to even do it, even if you could logically do it.
Yeah, I did look up your question about randomization. The analog devices part does not have randomization built in. It does have a chopper stabilization mode, which is for getting rid of DC offset in the A to D converter. And that DC offset causes a spike at zero in the down converted channel. So it will reduce that a lot. To do randomization, I think we can do that in logic in the FPGA if we have to have it. Essentially, we would have to run a pseudo random scrambler against the three LSBs of the data word.
Yeah, okay, and that's doable, no problem. And so that would be a randomization. So the chopper would be more like dither on the 2208.
The chopper doesn't have any equivalent on the 2208. It's a function that doesn't exist. And what the chopper does is it tries to get rid of DC offset errors in the track and hold circuit on the front end. At least that's my interpretation. The data sheet is really vague about what it does, but given the name and the fact that it gets rid of DC offset, I'm guessing it's a synchronous chopper around the track and hold.
So doesn't this ADC have a common mode output to go back to feedback to an amplifier to set the zero offset point?
There is a common mode voltage, but what that sets is the max and the min range of the common mode. So it sets where the logic swings, or not the logic swings, the voltage swings on the analog signals driving the ADD come to. So, you know, it'll be in a differential sense, minus some voltage to plus some voltage, but single-ended, of course, those will be different numbers. So those just set the common mode range, but they don't do anything about the DC offset. That's what the chopper does.
Okay, because it seems to me the 2208 has a common mode output pin that's an analog voltage that says basically if you put it in in two's complement mode, it tells you where the zero point is, and you could feed that back to the ADC input amplifier to set the center voltage at that point. And it doesn't work 100%, but it generally, it's an offset input to the amplifier to correct for offset errors.
Okay, I'll have to take a look at that. I didn't see that on the, I haven't read carefully enough the ADC driver yet. It just mentioned that it just set the common mode range input, but it didn't mention anything about nulling. I'll have to take a look at that.
Yeah, because what we did on the 2208 is we took the output, the VCM output, and we filter it, and then we feed it back to the CM input of the amplifier, and it helps keep the DC offset. It keeps the DC offset from accumulating, shall I say.
Okay. In the transformer coupled case, I think it's not going to accumulate. My reading of the part was, is it set compatibility of the common mode ranges of the two parts? But like I said, I didn't go back to the older parts and read exactly how they did it. I've been spending more time focusing on the newer part.
Okay, well, if you'd have a Hermes schematic, we hooked it up that way, so I don't know if it's the same. It may not even be the same function.
Yeah, that's okay. The chopper is to get rid of DC offset in the analog devices part, and then it has a separate VCM, which is the common mode voltage range, and that has to be fed back to the ADC driver separately.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same thing here, the VCM. Okay, and was that schematic segment that I sent you useful in showing how to do busing?
Yeah, I'll take a look at that. And, you know, that'll probably clean up the schematic page a little bit. And I'm sure I can play with it for a few minutes and figure out how it works.
Yeah, because the trick is that every signal has to have a name. And in reality, all of the busing, all the graphical busing symbols and everything on the page basically do nothing. Because if you hook the same label on two nets, they're connected together if they're on the same page. So really, you don't, the graphical stuff is just for your information. But it, to me, if you don't connect it graphically, it makes the thing really hard to read. So I always use bus connectors. And I use the fat bus trace for busing, as you saw on that schematic. And then you need to put a name on the bus that matches all the segments that are run through that same bus wire. And the trick is the bus names all have to end in a number. So you can't have like D0 plus, D1 plus, D2 plus. It has to be D plus 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, because it increments the last digit.
Okay, thank you for that. I understood about the graphical symbol being meaningless, but ending in a number is important. And I would have made the mistake of, you know, trying to put, you know, stars for false or something like that after the end, and wouldn't have been able to figure out what's going wrong.
Yeah, our convention for false is underscore little n, lowercase n. And of course, you can't put that after the number, otherwise it doesn't work. So if you have a bus of negative true signals, you have to put like D underscore N 0, 1, 2, 3, like that. And you use square braces to put the numbers in, and that denotes the thing that gets incremented.
Oh boy. Okay. Well, I'll shoot you an email when I get to that point.
Well, if the PDF I sent you wasn't good enough, I can send you a DSN of that page, and you can actually click on things and look to see how they're constructed.
Okay, if the drawing shows the brackets, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah, I know busing cleans up cheats very nicely, because that reduces all those wires down to just one. And you know, you can actually put... But you probably can't do the clocks if they're clock plus and clock minus. But and I guess technically you can hook anything you want to the bus, but because like I said, it connects the node names together. The busing is just visual aid for humans to read. but I never mix, homogeneous or heterogeneous signals on one bus, like, you know, clock and reset and data out on one bus. That's a no-no.
Okay, why is that?
Just first aesthetic reasons. I believe it'll still work as long as you stay on the same page. However, the interpage connections depend upon the name of the bus, so you can't put heterogeneous signals on it if you're going to go off the page, because there's no way to connect them, because it's going to have one name.
Okay, I'll try to put the bus and the A to D converter on the same page, because that's where the majority of the interconnects will be.
Yeah, and are you using C size sheets?
Yes, C size.
Yeah, I think that this, to me, that's the best compromise between printable readability and having big enough sheet that you can actually put something on a page.
I tried a B size page, and the connector wouldn't fit. It overlapped the top and the bottom of a B size.
Yeah, and I suppose technically we could split that connector into two, but connectors don't logically split into two very easily. So if it fits on a C, that's better.
Yeah, well, they split into two real easily. You just need a hacksaw.
Hammer and a chisel.
Say, Scotty, I have some feedback for you. I did check November 4th. We will be on Central Time for me, which is an hour off, and so will be 2 o'clock UTC. That allows those of us in the United States, except for you, to stay at the same time.
Okay, so everybody's the same time except Arizona, which is the same time, but it's different now.
That's right. So the way to get it right is whatever 2 UTC is in your local time, but it's designed so that most of us that have changing time will join the session at the same time in the evening.
Yep. So local time for everyone who goes off of daylight time, it'll stay the same because it'll move from 0100 to 0200. And that starts next Monday, right?
Yeah, November 4th. It starts on November 3rd, but our next session is November 4th.
Okay, so that's good for me. That gives me an extra hour to get home, so I'll have no excuse to be late next week.
I hope I confused everybody so they won't know when to be here.
Well, you know, we're all hams, so 0200 Zulu, that should work for everyone if they can do the conversion.
Yep. We do have, Rick has come back. I don't know if he wants to have anything, some comments, and Rob is here as well.
Well, I'm here. Sorry, I had to step out just as the meeting started. Anyway, I spent last week at the MSAT symposium meeting with some interesting people and talking about some interesting project ideas, some of which could conceivably use our hardware for other purposes. Depends on how mature it gets and how quickly. So I got set back. I started working on the GPS steered oscillator board, and I was just looking at parts placements to see if everything would fit, and it seems like it might on the small footprint we have available. But then there were some comments that caused me to sit back and not pursue this schematic just yet. I thought it might be just a little premature. There were some discussions on what features were wanted and what cost profiles were acceptable and so forth. So I went on and did some other things, but I'll get back to that if the schedule requires prototype schematic quickly. It won't take me that long to put it together, I don't think. anyway, I've had an awful lot of other projects going on here, and I'm trying to clean as much of those out of here as possible before something like this starts consuming a lot of my time. But that's, I think that's all I have to say for now.
The silence is deafening. I have a question for Nathaniel. Are you there, Nathaniel?
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you see the post from, what's his name, Larry, on the Jove project?
I did. I didn't look at the specs in detail, but I did see his post. I can bring it up again.
Yeah, because I'd like... to try and match up the specs that his requirements to what our capabilities are. And I think I read through the spec. It's only about a page and a half. And I'm pretty sure we can do everything that he wants. He's going to want an FFT in the FFPGA and an FFT in the FPGA. And he's looking for energy levels. And I wasn't clear whether he wanted them broken out into energy levels per bin or an energy level in the whole spectrum.
Yep. I've got his document up right now. I'm not sure. I would think he would want it per bin. I don't think they just want to integrate it over the entire spectrum.
Yeah, because he wants to, his frequency of interest is 15 to 35 megahertz.
Yeah, I'd imagine, my guess is they do want some sort of resolution on there, because if you are just integrating the entire spectrum, that makes it harder to know what you're looking at. And based on the few things I've seen that have come out of Radio Jove before, a few things I've looked at for their spectrograms, I would think they want, you know, yeah, one energy per bin.
Okay, yeah, because I know they have a variable number of bins that they want to tell us how many to provide them with, so I would guess they don't really need anything other than, like, an energy level. That's all the information about they need to know about that bin, about each bin.
That sounds right to me.
And it's probably not very fast, either. I mean, how often do you suppose they need a report? Like, can we integrate over, like, in each bin, integrate over a second, or some long time?
I'm not sure, but that is possible. A second might be possible, but I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, or he may have a variable amount of time that he wants to tell us how long to integrate over. He got into some of that math there that I'm not really sure about, but I think the receiver specs, the 14-bit ADC and the sensitivity and all that, I think we can meet that. Although, I don't know, maybe this is a question for Tom. He says he wants a noise figure of 5 dB, does that make sense?
Yeah, that to do that is going to require a preamplifier. The receiver architecture won't be that good.
But we might be able to use an external preamplifier to get to that noise figure.
Yeah, he also had requirements on the number of spurious signals, more than just just a very few dB out of the noise. And that one, you know, I'm not sure about the Hermes, for example, would never come anywhere close to meeting those requirements. I don't know what ours is going to look like in terms of number of spurs. He's got some extremely severe requirements there.
Yeah, I know when you put a 50-ohm resistor on the antenna, you can only have like one spur, and it has to be below 10 dB above the noise floor. And then you could have, like, if they're 8 dB, then you could have two of them. If they're 5 dB, you could have three and things like that.
Yeah, that I haven't looked at what we would have, but based on previous SDR receivers, my view is that's going to be a very, very difficult requirement to meet.
Yeah, so where do you suppose that comes from, that quietness, because if the spurs are known, we can subtract them off, but of course that doesn't give us the required sensitivity at that frequency.
Yeah, I don't know. Of course, the thing you worry about is putting a preamp on, you may also pick up some additional spurs. So when I looked at the receiver requirements, you know, they're not that different from what we're doing, but the numerical values are going to be a challenge in one or two places.
Yeah, and again, he might this might be his ideal receiver, but if nobody can meet the specs, then he might settle for something a little bit looser.
Yeah, I'm not sure the source of the specs. You get a lot of spurs that arise from, you know, interesting beats, between various clock and sample rates and down conversion rates. And I know there's a couple on Hermes that are, you know, like S9 kind of spur levels. And so, you know, whether we're going to have those or not remains to be seen.
Do you know if those are real RF spurs that the ADC is converting, or are they? I mean, S9 seems like a little bit high for something that would be an artifact of the conversion.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They show up in the output spectrum on that receiver. And so, you know, if you're a user of the receiver, you would say, yes, there's a spur there. But I don't know what the cause is.
Of course, our hardware is going to be much quieter than Hermes, right?
Well, I would, let's build a prototype first.
Yeah, okay. Spoken by someone who's built one before. I know it took us 3 tries on Mercury to get it quiet enough.
Yeah, hopefully we have a fairly simple board, and I've tried to eliminate all active components out of the input path. And so, you know, I'm trying to do everything I can to quiet it down.
Well, if you put all the SPI stuff down by the 140-pin connector, where all the digital stuff is, and keep the analog stuff on the other end, and make sure we put at least one layer of ground between the bottom of the board and the top of the board, so we try to shield all the noisy junk that's going on in the data engine, we might have a chance.
Yeah, the analog devices part, the digital ground and the analog ground are common, and they're a big metal slug in the center of the bottom of the package.
Yep, that's pretty normal. So, and we've really found that there's a lot of key ways to lay the board out. Like when you lay any digital traces out, you want to make sure that they don't cross over any breaks in the ground path, because the ground return currents on those switching signals will find a path. If it happens to be underneath where your analog signals go, then you got trouble.
Yeah, I intended to have a uniform ground plane under the digital portion of the receiver, and 2 isolated ground planes. And the only thing crossing between the isolated planes and the unified plane is the transformer. So the only thing that would ever cross through is a transformer that actually electrically isolates the 2 sides.
Yeah, so only the transformer leakage is all you're going to ever get across the plane.
Well, yeah, that's the theory.
Well, and there is capacitive coupling between the primary and secondary, so at high frequency you could get something there. But anyway, it was something else I was going to say. Oh, yeah, I was going to suggest that maybe we make provision to put a can on the top of the board as a shield.
Yeah, I think that may be needed. The intention was at least up to the front of the A to D converter driver chip that we be able to shield that part of the receiver if necessary. When I lay it out, I'm going to probably install some 0-ohm do not insert resistors between the various ground planes, so that if we find something strange, we could install a 0-ohm resistor and short the grounds together.
Okay, sounds good. So it occurred to me on this Vim board that Dan and I were using, it's got an M.2 connector. It has a USB 3.0 port going to it. So we could theoretically take the Lime Mini and relay it out, and we could plug it into the bottom of the CPU board, and we'd have an entire system in one case all ready to go.
How would you, so what would you do, build a USB to M.2 paddle or something?
Well, you build a custom M.2 board with the Lime chip on it, and the Lime Mini uses a FTDI 601 FIFO to USB chip, and it's got an FPGA on the board. It's got a small one, so we could put a little bit bigger one on there, and we'd end up with a complete radio that talks USB 3, and that USB 3 port comes out to the M.2 connectors routed there. Their M.2 uses PCIe and USB 3 as selectable. So if you want to put a SSD in, then you make it a PCIe SSD. And if you want to use a custom board, you can route the whatever your data is to a USB 3 on the M.2, select that, and then you've got a USB 3 peripheral.
Okay. While I was at the Microwave Update conference, I measured the Edis radio. They had a Rode & Schwarz phase noise test set, and I'm sure that the price tag on it was somewhere near a good sized house. But we're able to measure the they said they had measured some line boards, and we measured the B205 that I had.
So how did it come out?
The Edis board below in the first band below, a gigahertz. I don't know where the cutoff is. We measured it at 400 megahertz. It was very good, had very good phase noise at 400 megahertz. It was about minus 120 dBc at a kilohertz or 10 kilohertz offset. But up in the gigahertz range, we measured it up at 2.4 gig, and it was about 30 dB noisier up there. And up in the 2.4 gig, the Edis and the Lime kind of looked about the same.
Okay, because that, okay. So that's interesting because I think that uses a 9361, doesn't it?
Yeah, the Edis board uses the analog devices part. I forget the number, but it's the one that's got about six VCOs on it, and they bank switch the voltage controlled oscillators. And I think they don't need one on the lowest frequency, and then they start using them as you go up into the towards 6 gigahertz. They keep switching in higher ones. The single sideband guys at the MUD conference said that when it's up at minus 90 dBc, it's a pretty trashy transmitter, and they would discourage folks from using those for sideband. But at minus 120, that it's a good clean transmitter, and that would be acceptable on the air.
So what frequency do you think it'd be usable at, up to 2 gig?
No, at 2.4 it was pretty awful. My guess is it depends on what frequency they switch oscillators on that particular analog devices chip. It's north of 400 and south of 2.4, but my guess is it's probably about 1 gigahertz where they go from the low frequency regime to the first VCO based down conversion scheme. So I'm going to guess that 900 or a gig is where it suddenly switches into the mode where it looks pretty noisy.
Yeah, because what they make up for in quality up there is the versatility that you get, but it gets pretty performance gets pretty dicey when you get up that high.
Yeah, well, when you're operating in wideband modes, you don't really need the good phase noise performance. Phase noise is most critical on narrow band modes. So single sideband being 3 kilohertz wide, the phase noise is real, real important. But if you're using the radio as a data radio and you're sending 10 megabits per second, then the phase noise is not very relevant.
I think we could build a whole lot of different RF modules to go on this once we get the thing rolling.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see if some other parts come out that would support cleaner, you know, cleaner transmitters and receivers for ham use. I'm not sure if that's very much of a focus of the industry, however.
But at least with both the output and input channels on the RF module, we'll be able to do some pure signal transmitters.
Yeah, but that would be for HF. I was thinking, you know, in terms of UHF or microwave, there's going to be a real challenge supporting narrowband modes from commercially available parts.
Yeah, but like you said, do they really use narrowband modes up on those high frequencies?
Well, hams do, if you know, but I think we're probably going to find that's not going to be as useful. We'll have to end up using the wider band data modes. I think the phase four ground was all pretty much wide band data modes, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a LDPC encoded like a 10 megahertz. I don't know what kind of modulation they use, but it's basically a DVBS signal.
Okay, yeah, so that's not so sensitive, and the existing parts are likely to be good candidates there. Good heavens, did we totally monopolize the conversation tonight?
Yeah, I could talk a little bit about some of the other things that I'm working on.
Please do.
Sure. So I'm working with Steve Serwin a little bit and the Case Western people. And I'm not sure if this group is where I think they are. You know, we had the WWV Festival of Frequency Measurement earlier this month, October 1st, right?
Yes.
Okay. So there were about 40 people who submitted observations from that. And one of the better ones was Steve Serwin, and he gave us really nice Doppler shift measurements of WWV, and you can see really interesting observations on both the 2.5, the 5 megahertz, and the 10 megahertz band, with more variability at night, less during the day. And so we're working on trying to figure out, you know, what exactly that means.
Okay, well, that sounds good. So isn't that really what the Case project is going to help determine? I mean, how's that receiver going?
I think it's coming along. And yes, that is what the Case project is going to help determine. And I'm hoping that the Tangerine SDR will be able to have a mode that's compatible with the Case mode as well, so that we can have both the inexpensive one receivers and the Tangerine SDRs all be able to contribute to a common data set when we want to.
Yeah, I think that's easily doable. Maybe not so easy, but it is doable. And because I was at DCC, I saw the example there that Christina had going, but it was only a one-band unit so far, and I was just curious how they're coming along and getting the multi-band simultaneous receivers working.
I think they're planning on mixing the multiple frequencies down into a common audio band, and then getting the Doppler shift from all within that one audio band.
So they'll have a mixer with multiple LOs, or they'll have multiple mixers?
I'm not exactly sure of the underlying architecture.
Because it seemed like if they filtered it right, I don't know, that might be a nightmare of filtering to inject multiple LOs in and try to get offset streams. It's because I think they're originally going to get a wideband audio stream that had each of the WWV data streams in it offset by some amount, so that the Pi could actually decode all of them with DSP.
Right, I believe so.
Yeah, so I talked to Christine, and she wasn't clear as to exactly how they were going to do that. I mean, sounds like there's a couple ways they could do it. It would require different hardware, but they're just getting started on that.
Yeah, I think they are. I know they have a prototype that has been running, but I don't know the exact hardware details of it.
Yeah, we saw the one they had at DCC, and it had a synthesizer that you can set to 2.5, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, but you could only receive one frequency at a time that you could. You could jumper it, or I think you actually hooked the PC up to it and programmed the synthesizer to the right frequency.
Right. I'm trying to look for Steve's measurements that he posted on Zenodo. I found one of them, but I know he came up with a more recent version of this presentation that included multiple frequencies. But I found the one that at least gives a 5 megahertz observations.
I guess
I'll send that link to the Tangerine to the chat window.
Sorry, I missed that. Your audio is a little low.
Oh, I just sent a link of Steve Serwin's observations on 5 megahertz to the Tangerine SDR window.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I saw that. Did you talk to Phil Karn about some of the issues that they're having with frequency accuracy at WWV?
I don't think I, to Phil Karn, I don't think I have.
Scotty?
Go ahead.
I talked with Phil Erickson about this, and he was well aware of what, Phil was talking about. The other Phil Karn was talking about.
Okay, because I know I aimed Phil Karn at, Christina to talk to her about it, because they had some issues with modulating the carrier with the data that they were sending, which sounded like it might lead to some unexpected results on the case. Well, on ours too, but the case is going to be there before us.
If I remember right, Phil Erickson said there were two different modulators, and one had this problem more than the other one.
Yeah, they use two different amplifiers, and one for 25 and 2.5, 5, and 25, oddly enough. And then I think 10, 15, and 20 use a different one. I may have the transmitters wrong, but apparently they had some kind of grid coupling on the one so that the amplitude of the input signal changed the frequency slightly.
Well, the story I got from Phil Erickson was that in those tests where he traveled around Colorado sampling, he got exactly the same thing that Phil Karn got.
Okay, so he corroborated that because the guys at WWE admitted that it was a problem, so it's not like a secret or anything.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure the guys at Case were aware of it, so because it you know, they might be tracing down anomalies in their system when there really aren't any.
How do these anomalies show up?
I think they show up as frequency shifts.
Okay, is it Doppler, does it happen bad. Continuously, or is it only at certain times of day?
I believe it's the architecture of the amplifier or something like that, so that one was doing it one way, one set of frequencies was doing it one way, and the other set of frequencies was doing it a different way, and you had to pay attention to what your expectation was on the two sets.
But wasn't it the fact that the modulation that they were doing, whether they were doing it, you know, which frequency tone they were doing, would actually change the carrier frequency ever so slightly? Did I misunderstand that?
I believe it was something like that. It was one of those late night talks, and so some of it's a little vague. I believe Dave Whitten was there as well.
But I'm just as vague about what exactly was said. I knew I was interested that there was an anomaly, but I'm not sure I grasped all of the causes.
Well, I could ping him and see if I can get him to explain it. It was one of those late night things where we were all kind of bleary eyed.
Well, the one thing is, I mentioned it to Phil Erickson, and he seemed to understand the issue and was not at all surprised by what I was saying.
So he already knew about it?
Yes.
My faith in WWV Ultimate Accuracy is shaken.
Now, it was just, apparently, as long as you understand what you're listening to, its accuracy is just the same.
Yeah, did you see, I don't know if Nathaniel, you saw this, but Phil wrote a WWV simulator for the Mac.
Phil Karn did. I think he presented it at DCC, not this year, but last year, right?
I don't remember that he did. Maybe I was, because I encouraged him to present it this year, so I didn't remember he did it last year.
He presented it at AMSAT Symposium, and he said it's on his personal website for anybody to take and look at. And if you want to use it, just give him credit.
Okay, very good, because I know he had a friend of his that's a blind guy who was listening to this, and he's decoding it by ear, and he found an error in Phil's encoding of the tone signal, the tick signals, and he detected it by just listening to the output.
Yes, I believe he did say something about that.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that really is.
Well, I'm sorry, your tone is off by 3 hertz. You're going to have to fix it.
Perfect pitch up into the megahertz.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, wow, it's quiet. Anything else for anyone? Well, Nathaniel, I am continuing to work on the schematic, but progress is impeded somewhat by other projects and by trying to get the protocol spec out, because I'm trying to get that updated enough so I can put it up out for comments to see if I'm anywhere near on target or not.
Okay, that sounds good. So the protocol spec is for between the data engine and local control, or which part of the protocol spec is this?
Right, it's the LCC, so local command and control between the single board computer and the data engine, and it's the specific commands and acts and exactly how you're going to talk to the board.
Okay, that sounds really good.
Yeah, because I'm going to need it to code the FGA to make it talk that command protocol. And stream, defining the streams, and I basically took the stream that Bill defined in the telecon we had a couple weeks ago. And so Personal Space Weather Station has its own data stream.
Okay, that sounds good.
And it's free form open, so we can add data streams as needed or modify them, because I think we can limit ourselves to a mere 64K different data streams. Hopefully I don't have to implement all of them in the same hardware.
Hopefully not. See, some other things I've been working on with the HAMSI workshop, it's coming along. I have the NSF is going to fund the HAMSI workshop again, which I think I announced. So I've just been, we have some of the main planning going on right now. Before I make any more announcements about it, I'm trying to just make sure that the grant goes all the way through And I think it should go through within the next week or so. And then I'll start building out the website with the information on sending abstracts and all of the details about the hotels and things like that.
Okay, good. So then we can sign up and make hotel reservations. Because it is, well, you know, it's really not that far away.
I know it's not. So, we do have the hotel picked out, and we have a weekend, so it should just be, we should be able to get the information out there soon.
But you don't have the block of rooms reserved at that hotel yet, right?
I don't think we have them quite yet, but we're very close.
So where is the, is it Philadelphia you'd fly into, the closest place?
No, there's actually a Scranton-Wilkes-Barre airport.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, its code is AVP, and it's about 15 minutes away.
I'm crazy enough, I'll probably end up driving out just for fun.
Yeah, that could be pretty cool.
Yeah, Nathaniel, how far from Newark Airport is the is Scranton?
2 hours.
Okay, so it's a little bit of a drive then.
Yeah, it's not terrible, but it's 2 hours. So, I mean, the problem with AVP, of course, is you probably have to take a small regional jet to get there. Although I did have a direct flight when I went to the Tapper meeting in Detroit. So anyone who's flying from Detroit, they might be able to get a direct flight in.
Okay, what airline was that on?
I think that was on Delta.
Okay, good. Delta's got a hub in Detroit, so that's convenient.
Yeah, so if you fly to Detroit, and then you can get a direct flight from Detroit to Scranton. And we're planning on having the block of rooms at the Hilton Hotel, which is about 2 blocks from the university.
So how far away is Philadelphia?
That's about 2 hours also. Yeah, Google says it's 2 hours and 3 minutes.
Can I step in here for a second?
Sure.
I wasn't here last week. Scotty and I think we're trying to get connected with Fred Harris about the digital demodulation technique. I think. Kind of dropped the ball on that, but I think Fred went away to Europe for a while. So are you still interested in pursuing it? I'll reconnect with Fred, see if we can't get a conference call together.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, because he said he was going out of the country, and then he said he didn't know when he was coming back because his wife had made all the reservations.
Yeah.
And then figured he'd get in touch with us when he was back.
Yeah. You know, I'll ping him. It's been a few weeks, so I'll ping him and see if he can have. Another subject I wanted to presentations from the DCC conference, are they up yet? I haven't found them anywhere.
The lightning talks are on the Tangerine website, which is linking to the YouTube site. The fellow Jason has not put up, he only put up Steve Bible's introduction and 12 lightning talks.
Okay. Well, my specific interest in it is that I wanted to contact and thank and make some questions of the fellow who made the presentation about solar power, because it was incredibly useful to me. We you know, we're in Northern California. We lost power for the last, for 36 hours. And his talk stimulated me to buy a inverter, and I was able to attach it to my the battery of my hybrid car, and we were the only house for, you know, in the for a mile around us that had power through the through this event, firestorm, power outage event. So I wanted to thank him, and I'm going to be kind of recommending it to other people and implementing other places. So I thought I'd explore it further, but I don't remember his name or how to contact him. So that was my.
It's Bob Barunica. I'm not sure about the spelling of the last name, but he's APR, isn't he? Scotty, his last end of his call sign, like a W-2 APR?
It's WB4 APR, Bob Bruninga, Bruninga. And he's on QRZ, so you can get his email address there.
Okay, that's good.
He'll be happy to hear your input.
Well, yeah, that was a very you know, kind of off the air topic, but it was interesting to watch KPH. I have it on battery backup, and it's still, you know, the power went down, it's still not back up. So we had about 12 hours Saturday night while it was on battery, and nothing for 50 miles around was had AC power. So it was interesting to see, look across the radio spectrum to see, you know, what a really quiet environment looks like.
Yeah, which Rob tried WB4APR at amsat.org.
Okay. APR, Alpha, Bravo, Romeo?
Whiskey, Bravo, 4, Alpha, Romeo. APR, like APRS. He's Mr. Oh. So, and he's at WB4APR at amsat.org.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So, well, that was, anyway, I've been working also, we are continuing our work with the Kiwis and my Whisper Daemon. We're setting up a couple of more calibrated receive sites. So we'll have a kind of a square of receive sites here in the West with KPH and then KA7 in Utah. And then one down in Las Vegas and another up in, I think, almost to Oregon. So we're hoping that with received data logging to my database, we could extend the analysis we're able to do of the waves which we thought we were seeing, the TIDs we thought we saw in data from this summer, but that came from only two sites. So,
are you going to include the site over in New Mexico that that Ned was talking about the past couple weeks?
I'm sorry?
When Ned was on here, when AA7A was on, he's working with the ARL Noise Reduction Committee, I guess, and they have a calibrated receive site on the Arizona-New Mexico border out in the middle of nowhere, east of Phoenix by like 250 miles.
Here. Yeah.
And he'd be interested in participating in that.
I'm very interested in talking with him directly. I guess he isn't here tonight, but right, is but
yeah, you can, I'll put his email address down here at the bottom, his name.
Okay, good. That will help me. I'm operating in a public space here, so I'm talking to you with one hand behind my back. So yeah, I should talk to him because we think we have some, you know, we think we'll be able to come back with some very good data. We, you know, just learned a bunch of stuff about, you know, the practical world. You know, it's really important to have, you know, extremely low bench laboratory measurements, but for noise and interference. But in the real world, as soon as you connect up a coax to an antenna, the impairments introduced by the real world in my experience, almost completely swamp any of the laboratory measurements and so on that I've been working, you know, now for 6 months to kind of whack-a-mole away at the various sources of impairments that are introduced in at KPH and Maui and elsewhere. And I think I'm getting down there, but
Ed said that they actually calibrated their site. I don't know what that exactly means, but it was a lot of work, so it must be significant.
Yeah, I'd love to get into understand their work because it would help me. And I think it's a really important contribution to the real world deployment of the Space Weather Station radios. It's there's just so much noise there. I think, again, we were working with John Ackerman and looking at his home site. It's just, I mean, he's got 30 dB more noise all over the place from all kinds of sources. And I think, you know, in a lot of places, you know, our experience has been a lot of times you can get rid of those, but it's not trivial, you know. As far as understanding of each site and each individual source of interference.
Yeah, well, I think Ned would like to hear from you, too. I put his name and an email address down there on the bottom.
Great. I will talk to him. Very good. Well, that's all I had for this week. Scotty, I'll try to talk to Fred Harris and see if we can't get.
Okay, sounds good. I'm not too far from San Diego, so if we need to meet or something, yeah, it would be good. But we can start with the telecon.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Did you say you were going to be out again?
No. I just said I'm not very far from there, and I have friends out there, so if I need to. But if it will be expeditious to come out and meet, that will be fine. But I think we can start with the telecon and go from there.
Okay. But I'll see what he's up for.
Scotty, Dave, is there any plan to put the PDFs of the DCC presentations up on the Tangerine website, the ones that at least weren't printed in the book?
Scotty, I don't know where they are, but if I hit them, I could put them up on our site.
Okay, I don't, normally they go up on the Tapper site. You know, I've been waiting for 2018 DCC to go up there. So I've got all the presentations in PDFs and PowerPoints. So
user joined your channel.
Both of the ones that I have in both are just the PowerPoints, or I guess we could export them to PDF. Let me see how I can get them to you the easiest way. Probably the FTP server is the easiest way. And I think, Tom, I got our FTP server up and running again. I hate to admit this is embarrassing. It was it had powered off during a previous power failure, and that's why it wasn't there.
Okay, well, that's a good reason.
Well, just let me know where to pick them up. I can handle a wide variety of different places where you store things. It'd be best if it was compressed into a single file. I can handle most compression algorithms, unless you pick something really weird. And just let me know, and I can do that. I keep watching Jason's site, but I have not emailed him. I guess I should. He got off and he was doing the Chattanooga ham show, and he's been doing several other things that have nothing to do with DCC, so it doesn't seem to be a high priority for him to catch up on these.
Okay, I'll light a fire under him. Well, I don't know if I can do that, but I'll talk to him anyway, see if I can motivate him a little more, because we'd really like to see those. And I think if he's realizes that there's people sitting there waiting for him, he might be more inclined to get on them sooner.
Yeah, and if anybody, I also put links to the 2018 videos, but the part from the 2018, I can't find any of the lightning talks.
Did you get all the rest of them for 2018?
So if you go on our website and go into videos 2018, the DCC should be there.
Oh yeah, okay, I see it. Yeah, and it looks like you have everything. Is that just the videos, and you need the talks? I mean, the slides, or you have everything you need.
Well, those are there, but I could actually put the slides in with each video if somebody wants to carefully read slides as opposed to look at the... they're a bit fuzzy on the YouTube video.
Because I have all the presentations for 18, and the lightning talks, it seems like there was only a couple of people that actually had slides, but I did. I had like Bob McGuire's slides, and I think at least one other for the lightning talks.
Well, I can keep poking around. I wanted to put stuff that was relevant to Tangerine and the ham psi kinds of things on our website so that most of that material was available in a fairly concentrated place.
Yeah, I did notice on 2018 you don't have Nathaniel's 4 hours and Nathaniel and Bill's 4 hour seminar. Did you not record? Did anybody record that?
I can't find it on Jason's site, so I don't know if he did it. I wasn't there, so.
Okay, I agree with you, Dave, that we ought to focus on the ham psi and tangerine SDR relevant DCC presentations for the webpage.
Yeah, and the 18th, the seminar is the one that you want to see.
Yes, and I don't know if anybody recorded it. Nathan, do you remember if anybody was recording?
I thought it was recorded. Let's see. Yeah, I can't remember who was doing the recording, but I thought it was recorded. I think, wasn't it Jason that was doing it?
Yes, Jason did 2018, but I can imagine he doesn't want to put up a 4 hour video, so he'd at least break it into pieces.
I mean, YouTube takes 4 hour videos these days, so that shouldn't be a problem, right?
Yeah, I think it's his time editing that he's worried about.
Okay. Well, I think you should encourage him because, you know, I included him in the NSF support for the HamSci workshop upcoming. So he might be willing to try and get that out there sooner if we tell him we really want it.
Sounds like a good idea. If he has, Scotty, if you talk to Jason and he has audio that he doesn't want to fool with, he could pass it on to you or me and we could at least put it on that on our site.
Yeah, okay, so I'll ping him and see what happened to that. I'm looking at on his YouTube channel right now, looking for it, and so far I haven't found it.
So YouTube makes it very confusing to find things, but if you go into the person's original website, there's usually a video link, and that's all the individual videos that they've uploaded. And you can go through that by time and look for what's been uploaded relevant to the subject. Now, they sometimes make a channel link, but that's only if the owner of the website has made it, and then they can put a bunch of videos that are related to one topic together. Jason likes to control the outside viewers in his main site so that he's got something there every couple days, but it isn't always on the same topic.
Okay, so where did you say I go to Jason's site to look for the grouped DCC videos?
Yeah, let me get the link and I'll post it.
Oh, I think I found it. It's the DCC archives.
For Jason's, yes, that's correct. Disconnected from your channel. But I'm going to show you another link.
Scotty, I'm going to need to take off. Y'all have a great week, and we'll see you at the same time or an hour later next week.
Okay, 7-3's Tom. Let me know if there's anything else you want me to send you.
Okay, just read the meeting minutes, which will be out in 1 minute.
Okay, great. And thanks again for doing that. That really helps.
User disconnected from your channel.
Scotty, I put up a link, and that is all of Jason's videos in order of his posting on YouTube.
So this is by episode number, right?
Well, it's whenever he makes a video and posts it, that's the way he would put it there first, and then he makes links to wherever he wants to present it to people who are looking at his website. So I go through there and find the ones that are about Tapper or DCC, and then I look at them in order, and if there aren't any others posted that are relevant to us, then I know he hasn't posted them, because you can see both 2018 and 2019 in that list if you look at the dates. And 2018 took him about 6 or 8 months to get all the videos edited.
Yeah, and I don't see the Sunday seminar here, so maybe he hasn't done that yet.
I'll bet he's thinking they're too long and people wouldn't be interested, but you might ask him about it.
Yeah, he could break it into 4 1-hour parts or something, but for a personal space weather station, that's probably that seminar is the single first thing someone should watch if they want to get up to speed quickly.
Well, the same thing about Tapper, the SatMod stuff. That was a really nice seminar, so hopefully he recorded that as well.
Yes, I know he did record that. I saw his cameras rolling during that.
But he is in the business of getting paid by YouTube for viewers, and long technical things don't get as many views as other things.
Yeah, that's true. So more work, less benefit.
Yes, and so he's probably has a disincentive about spending a lot of time on something that won't get him very many views.
Well, we can ask anyway, see whether he can do it.
Yep. So I'm trying to keep that our Tangerine site kind of relevant. Now I'm a bit behind on some of Bill's posting. He sent me like 4 or 5 things at once, and I got confused about what exactly he wanted me to do with them. So I'm going to try tomorrow to straighten those out, but I think they're about a week old and should have been up there.
Okay, these are the documents like on the time stamping we had the telecon on?
Yes, and they were PDF documents, and then I have to move old documents to the old and put the new ones on, but there were like 4 or 5 different documents all at one time.
Oh, okay. I'd like to keep the documents list here relevant to Tangerine and not have other stuff kind of filtering in from the side.
Well, there is the one thing that was an audio of a phone call. So I put that in a space that is called audio. And I don't know if I have a direct link yet, but I should do that. And it was the audio call between the digital RF folks at Haystack in Bill.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'd like to hear that. So you put a link up on the video page, or you make another main link and make it audio and put it there?
I made a directory that's audio, and the file is in there. And if you open it in, say, Chrome or Firefox, it just plays. But it's just the audio. There's no... Nathan said it was a Zoom meeting, but it's just the audio of the Zoom meeting.
Okay, I think I was in on that call. So that's because Phil was there and Bill was there and Rob, I think, was there from Case, and Nathaniel was there. Is that the one, Nathaniel?
Yeah, that's the one.
So it's in a directory on our website, audio, but I think I need to set up a link for you.
Yeah, okay, I see it. But yeah, we ought to have maybe just a link on the main page. Link on the main page for audio, because you have one for video.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and do that. I have a little time tomorrow to do that, so I'll try to get those things straightened out.
Okay, well, sounds good. We're considerably over our hour here, so anyone have anything else before you disband for the day?
I think that's it for me. I'm going to try to keep moving ahead on doing some of that data analysis, and I'm also talking to Bill about doing some project management work as well. So I'm trying to keep up with that.